Welcome to the Belfast Men's Health Group podcast with Owen Kernan. Owen is from Dublin and is a water sports enthusiast, and he's living with an eating disorder. So before we get to eating disorders and all the rest of it, Owen, how are you today? How's things?
I'm not too bad. I'm looking out the window at a beautiful sunny day, and I'm looking forward to getting out into that sunshine, hopefully to get on the water for a few hours. You mentioned there I'm a water sports enthusiast, and the water has become my therapist in the last few years. I've always enjoyed the water since I was a young kid, and growing up I became a competitive swimmer for years, and took to sailing, took to kayaking, and then recently in the last 10 years took to stand-up paddleboarding and kitesurfing. So I have a multitude of sports to pick from depending on whatever way the weather and the conditions are looking on any given day, but I'll always try and get out onto the water. The water gives me a space to either tune out or to tune in. To tune out in the sense that if I'm just having a rough time, or the brain is very busy, or just need a bit of space, I can get out onto the water and I can find a bit of space to just distract myself, to tune out, to relax, but also to tune in. Sometimes you can do your best thinking out on the water, I find sometimes. So if I'm struggling with a problem, or if I'm just trying to figure something out, I'll just go out on the water. Next thing you never know, but just in the most random of moments, the solution will come to you. The water is where I spend a lot of my time.
And I suppose, how did you get into it? Now, you did say that as a young boy you started swimming. What brought you to water?
My grandfather and my parents, because they were both sailors, they met through sailing. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather had a boat at the time that I was born, and there's pictures of me from about 6 months old, just as I was about to walk or just walking, harnessed up and attached to the boat, but sailing around the area that I now live in, which I think is quite nice. I moved away from that area in the interim period, but nowadays I've come back to the same place, Humpton in Dublin, and I do spend my time on the water in that same area as those pictures. So that was kind of how I got into it in the very early time. But then I suppose as a kid, we all search for a sport, or we search for an activity that we want to engage in. I wasn't an artist. I couldn't really play a tin whistle, to save my life. But I found swimming. I found competitive swimming. I engaged in that for about 12 years. And it was great. I really enjoyed it. It was a good sport to be involved in. But I fell out of love with it towards the end, because there was just too much involved. You were in the water, in the pool for too much every week. So I said, I have other things in life I need to think about now at this stage. And I got out of it. And I turned away from the water for a period of time, but more to the reason that I was living in land at this point. I was living not close to water. But as soon as I moved back to Dublin then, I very quickly found the water again and engaged in many different sports, just to try them all and give them all a go. Now I can pick and choose from five or six different water sports that I like to engage in.
Now, I'm not a great swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Could I engage in water sports, do some of the stuff that you do, paddleboarding and all that?
Absolutely, you could, Paul, for sure. I have this belief, and one of the things I do, so I have a stand-up paddleboarding school, Discover SUP is what it's called, and we're based out in Humpton, Dublin. Mm-hmm. And my attitude to anybody who comes to me wanting to try stand-up paddleboarding is that if you're willing, if you've got the courage to step up on a board and either kneel down, lie down, stand up, whatever you can do, we'll find your ability on that board. And that ability may not be that you're going to go and tour 20 kilometers every day along the Norwegian coastline, mm-hmm. and it may not be that you want to do a 12 kilometer race, you know, from here out to Ireland, die and back, mm-hmm. but it might just be that you want to just find the rhythm of the water. You want to get out on your board and you want to discover the rhythm of the waves or the rhythm of, you know, the wildlife around you, because there is a rhythm. And that's something I teach people, is that, you know, nowadays in life we're hit with all these irregular rhythms. So, for example, take your phone. The notifications that come in on your phone every day have no rhythm to them. You could be getting random messages here, there, and everywhere. And that causes us distress. That causes us a distraction in our lives. But when you go out on the water, you'll soon very quickly find that the waves that are coming underneath you will be coming in a rhythm. They come in a rhythm with the tide, and they come in a rhythm in terms of set. Surfers have known this for years, and that they come in sets of 7 or 8. And all of a sudden, when you tune into that, your body has found a rhythm that it can engage with, and it can find peace in, find relaxation in. And it's a great antidote to, you know, the way life works at the moment, which is very, very much without rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you see an owl lad with a white beard coming down, it's not Santa, it could be me.
So, no problem at all. You never know.
Right. Oh, so moving on then, Owen, and into eating disorders. Forgive me, what, and our listeners, what is an eating disorder?
Ooh, that's a loaded question, because there's quite a lot to it. And I think people, I suppose, at the outset might, when you say the word eating disorders, people might immediately think, oh, they just don't like to eat, or they're, you know, they're afraid of eating. But eating disorders have many different facets mm-hmm. to them. And I suppose what I want to say before we go on to anything else is I will be speaking on my own behalf about my own lived experience with a particular variation of eating disorders, let's say, but yeah. they are all equal. Mm-hmm. Every eating disorder is equal. They all come from the same place. And it's important to recognize that, because not every eating disorder gets the same headlines mm-hmm. in the media, let's say, or the same visibility in the media. But to answer your question, what is an eating disorder? An eating disorder is basically where someone has a preoccupation with or anxiety around food. And then you add on to that in some degree, whether it might be a preoccupation or anxiety around over-exercising as well, depending on the type of eating disorder. But essentially, where it comes from, or the reason, you know, generally the reason for an eating disorder, for someone developing an eating disorder, is if you can imagine. So we've all, I'm sure, at some point, and your listeners at some point will have had a rash on their skin, or a rash on their body at some in some place, and that has come from an allergic reaction inside, to something they've ingested or something that they have touched or whatever it might be. And so that allergy is now showing itself or manifesting itself as a rash on the skin. And an eating disorder is a very similar type thing. It's basically an allergy inside. It's an emotional allergy to something in life or something in their personal way of being that is causing a rash, which is the behaviors of an eating disorder. And I hope that analogy makes sense for people. It's it's a visible reaction to an internal emotional allergy, if that makes sense. And I suppose it's something that people can find very hard to understand, because at the end of the day, we need to eat. You know, we need to have food to be able to live every day, to do the things we want to do, to, you know, get out on the water like I want to get out on the water. We need to have fuel in our bodies. We need to have energy in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And for people to have anxiety around that, or people to have worries and concerns and preoccupations with that, for those who don't live with an eating disorder, that can be very hard to understand. Mm-hmm. So I think the go on.
No, I was going to say, how did you then discover that you had an eating disorder?
Well, I suppose to go back and just explain before how I discovered it, explain how it developed, because that's part of the discovery is part of that journey, let's say. I, for many years, 36 years of my life, I lived quite obliviously to any struggles or worries that I had inside. I was living what I called the standard model of life. I was trying to achieve a career. I was trying to achieve owning a house. I was trying to achieve, having a happy relationship with my partner. Mm-hmm. And we were hearing, from different angles, you need to start having kids and things like that. So all those standard things were happening, along with, very happy things in my life. I was, I was getting out. I had a great group of friends, and myself and my partner were enjoying life. But what I didn't realize then was towards the end of 2018, a few things happened which kind of made me realize or made me start thinking that I was not valuable. I was not worthy in life. If I stood beside someone in I'd say on the beach, or if I stood beside someone in an office or whatever, I felt like I was always the smaller person. I felt like I was always the person that was not worthy, I did not match up to these other people. And so I took on this idea that if I ate clean, if I ate healthily, if I focused on my food, I would start to turn my body into something that people would like, something that people would feel is a strong body, something that people would feel is a body that, or a person that would be worthy of, worthy and capable of doing great things. Mm. And so I started on this journey towards the end of 2018, which for the first month was great. I was, I was enjoying some lovely, and in inverted commas, clean and healthy food. But after about a month, it started to turn quite dark because this obsessiveness around the provenance of my food, the what my food contained and how it was cooked became the priority. Not the enjoyment of the food, not the different flavors, not the different tastes, but just the idea of this food has got to be the cleanest it can be. It has to be the purest it can be, and that's all I'll put in my mouth. Mm-hmm. So processed foods went out the door, and any foods that I suppose have a bit of flavor to them went out the door, basically. And that turned into a thing called orthorexia. Orthorexia is not a diagnosable eating disorder at the moment. It's not in the DSM manual, but it should be, in my belief, because it is probably a hell of a lot more prevalent than anybody realizes because of that idea of clean eating and healthy eating, stuff, which is what we see nowadays in terms of a lot of people using gyms and things like that. That's this mantra that they have, clean eating. So it turned into orthorexia. And orthorexia can mask itself as just a healthy lifestyle. But deep down, I was developing this anxiety around food. I was developing this anxiety around over-exercising as well. I was walking, I was walking many, many kilometers too much every day. And various things like that. I won't go into all of the behaviors of it because, anybody listening, I wouldn't want to encourage them to compare their behaviors against what I did. But let's just say they were very destructive, the behaviors. So then moving on from that to I suppose, answer the question as to how did I discover that I had an eating disorder. I was using a particular app on my phone to engage in one of my behaviors. This app just allowed me to do particular things that my brain told me I needed to do. And within that app, there was a blog. And that blog fed me with information on, food and things like that. And when I look back at that information now, I realize how irrational and unhealthy it was. But one day, an article appeared in that blog that said, consider these different points, consider these different bullet points. And if you are experiencing any of these bullet points, maybe consider asking for a little bit of help with that, because maybe you might be developing an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. I had 7 of the 8 points.
Wow.
And it woke me up straight away. I went, wow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And probably one of the proudest moments in my journey so far is that moment, because when I read that, I turned around to my partner straight away and I said, listen, have a read of that. And she read it and she said, yeah, okay. That all sounds a little bit like what's been going on for the last few months. Because up until this point, we had both believed and understood that everything that I was doing was good. All of the behaviors that I was engaging in were good. And I, in a way, was convincing her that everything that I was doing was good. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't doing that from a malicious point of view or from a point of view of, you know, trying to be mean or trying to be, you know, trying to be, I don't know what the word is, controlling or anything like that of her, but I was, at the same time, I was making myself and her believe that all of these behaviors were good. So I showed her that, and that then started a process, and that process was, okay, we need to, you know, look into this a little bit more. So we did, and in the beginning, I didn't mind looking into it because I didn't think too much about it. I just thought, yeah, okay, we just start asking a few questions. But what happened within the next few weeks after that, let's say, is I started to turn away from wanting to get help. I started to turn away from wanting, you know, to ask the questions, because I was beginning to realize that these behaviors that I developed had become my best friend. They've become the only thing in life that I could absolutely trust, because what my eating disorder was signifying to me was I felt like the rest of my life was out of control. I felt like all the different things that, you know, I was being told I had to do. So, you know, start a family, buy a house, engage, you know, develop your career. They were all things I couldn't control. Mm-hmm. What I could control was the eating disorder. So that's why this had started. I didn't realize it at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I only realized it now as, you know, as I started to, you know, I suppose, investigate it a little bit more. But what I also didn't realize was that this disorder, which had started as orthorexia, had then developed into anorexia without me realizing it. Because what had started to happen was I had started to lose body mass. And as a result of losing body mass, I was seeing a number on a scale drop. And that was the only thing in life that I could see was something that I was achieving. I was achieving a number to fall. Whether it was good or bad for my body, it was happening. And I could control it, and I could do it. So I ended up engaging in some very destructive behaviors for the next couple of months, which saw me lose 2/3 of my body mass and become, as I describe it, a walking skeleton and pretty much dead to life. But I couldn't give up this behavior because it was my best friend, because it was the person that was keeping me safe in essence. You know, that's what my brain was telling me, even though that was a little bit irrational to think. There was a part of me that looked back at it now and says, do you know what? It was actually a good thing though, because it meant I didn't turn to drugs. I didn't turn to gambling. I didn't turn to drink. I didn't turn to anything else. So you have to kind of, in a strange way, say thank you to it too for trying to keep you safe in a world that you felt you were very unsafe in. And again, for your listeners, that might sound a little bit strange, but is at the end of the day, that's what it's trying to do. It is really, you know, the eating disorder that you're living with is really just trying to keep you safe.
And how did you get to the fixing it, or, you know, moving on, bringing some sort of balance back into your life?
So what happened from there was, I think my partner and my parents, more than me, started to realize that something needed to be done about this. Probably because I found it difficult because I was in a bit of denial about it, and also I was afraid of giving it up, as I said. So for them, they started to cajole me a little bit into, let's look into this a bit further. And I think what I'm going to tell you now might surprise some people. It may not surprise some other people. But the first port of call was a GP. The GP I had had up to that point. And their answer to me was, eat a few extra nuts and berries for your breakfast. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, like, that's just the most ridiculous thing to say to someone. But whether that was out of ignorance, that mm-hmm. they just didn't know what an eating disorder was, didn't know how to recognize the symptoms of it, or whether that was out of the fact that GPs are under so much pressure nowadays to get people through the system as quickly as they can. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got 10 minutes in front of them, 15 minutes if you're lucky, and, you know, they probably are already making a judgment on what the condition is before you've even sat down, you know. So I think they're under fierce pressure as it is themselves anyway. But that was the first thing I was told, was just eat a little bit extra for your breakfast. I couldn't even put milk in my cereal, let alone add extra nuts and berries to it.
Wow.
So, you know, that was difficult at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But then from there, it got even worse. I ended up engaging with about 13 to 14 different therapists and therapeutic services, let's say, to try and, you know, just find someone who would get me. Mm-hmm. And no one got me. No one understood eating disorders. Eating disorders, I don't know what it is, but eating disorders seem to be quite the knowledge on how to help someone with eating disorder is not out there in the system at the moment. So why I found that particularly difficult was every time I went into someone and sat down in front of them and was, you know, all ready to explain my worries and explain what was going on, by the end of that session, I was in floods of tears. By the end of that session, I was traumatized, because I'd have to bring up and start talking about all of the different things that I was finding difficult in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, either to be told, well, do you know what, we're probably not the right service for you, or you know, mm-hmm. just different things like that. Or also, what I found even more difficult was, you would talk to one person who would then say, well, look, I'm going to refer you on to my senior or onto my colleague. Can you come back tomorrow? So you say, I'll come back tomorrow, and you come back and you walk into the room, and the person that you're dealing with has no idea why you're there. So you're starting all over again. There was no continuity of, you know, service or continuity of passing on the knowledge. So that whole process for the next 2 months or so was extremely traumatic, and dealing with the health system. So for anyone out there listening who maybe is just about to engage in that, or just about to, you know, to open up about an eating disorder and ask for help, be prepared for that, and make sure that you have support around you. Make sure that you have some sort of close, trusted support that you can, you know, you can fall back on. In my mm-hmm. case, it was my partner. In my case, it was my parents. So for them, it was as difficult as it was for me, because, you know, they didn't like to see me in the distress that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
So that brought us on 2 months down the line. It all came to a head. I decided enough was enough. I didn't want to exist anymore. And suicide is the answer, because I couldn't put up being told I had to give up my eating disorder, being challenged by that, but also being challenged by all the pressures of life. And as someone who's quite logical and quite smart, being totally confused by the whole thing, and being totally bamboozled by why I was feeling the way I was feeling and why I was doing the things I was doing, but also by being confused by why could I not handle life? Why could I not handle, you know, all these different struggles and pressures in life? And so I just decided that enough was enough. Thankfully,
Where did the final support come from? Where did the answer lie for you, Ewan?
So what happened was that particular night, I decided that, you know, I wasn't going to exist anymore. And thankfully that didn't happen. Thankfully I came through that. And 2 days later, I found myself in intensive residential therapy, intensive residential support specifically for an eating disorder. And it was private support. When I found myself in the hospital 2 days previous to that in the A&E, their only answer was they could put me into their general psychiatric ward. And the psychiatrist on call that night recognized that was not going to be the right place for me. So they sent me home, and I ended up in private therapy 2 days later, voluntarily, but with a lot of pushing and kicking from behind from my partner and my parents to say, oh, this is the answer. I committed to saying I was going to live for 2 weeks and I was going to come back out solved and fixed, and everything was going to be fine. they knew it was going to be 3 months or more, at least. And it was 3 months. It was 84 days in that centre to get help, to start the process of getting help. And the reason I ended up in there was because things had gotten particularly bad. Not everyone will have to go to a residential centre, and let me put that out and say that straight.
Yeah, yeah.
Not everyone requires that degree of help. Mm-hmm. But for me, it had gotten to that point. And for a lot of others, it does get to that point, but not everyone needs that. But what you do need is you do need to start the talk therapy. Talk therapy is the answer to this. Talk therapy is the answer to a lot of mental illness, because we don't talk. We don't talk enough. We don't have the time to talk these days. That's the problem. We're expected to just be able to deal with these things and the problems of life as they come up. And if we can't deal with them, we don't have time to sit down and look at it. What that space and what getting into that particular facility gave me is it gave me the space to do that. I'm very privileged that I was given the space to do that, to put pause on my life and say, do you know what? Now on, you can sit back, you can, you know, look at everything you've been doing to date, look at everything you want to do for the rest of your life and figure out where the mismatches are and figure out where the issues are and the problems lie. Not everyone gets to do that, but please, if you are out there listening with any sort of a mental illness or any sort of a problem with life at the moment, just open up to a loved one, open up to your partner, open up to, you know, a friend. You'd be surprised the reaction you'll get from someone, because we are all empathetic humans at the end of the day. Well, most of us are, there's very few that aren't. And if someone holds their hand, out to you, what would you do? You'd of course take their hand and say, what can I do to help? Yeah. And that's what, you know, most people will do for you if you ask for that help yourself. So, you know, at the end of the day, that's the process I went down. I started talk therapy. I started various other therapies. I did also start on medication. And I'll be open and say, you know, for me, that was one of the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it was a solution is it's not my only solution. And it's not the only crutch that I walk around on nowadays. But what it does do is it gives me a little bit of brain space to do the other thinking. It allows the brain to calm down a little bit so that then I can find the space to engage with the psychotherapist properly, or engage with the, you know, art therapist properly, or just to have a little bit of breathing space, you know, which is what we didn't have, or what I didn't have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So medication was another answer. It's not going to be my answer for the rest of my life. At some point I will finish it, I hope. Mm-hmm. But I'm not afraid of it either, you know, and it's not a taboo for me.
Yeah, well, I suppose this question then goes right back to the first question, which is, how are you doing, or where are you on your journey now? It sounds good, and some great advice there. It sounds like you're in a good place now, Owen.
I'm in a good place right now talking to you on the phone. I can say that. But that doesn't mean that tomorrow I'm going to feel like, you know, pardon my French, but I'm going to feel like shit.
Yeah.
You know? But I've become very aware to how I'm doing. I think that's where I would say I'm at the moment. I'm not very good all day, mm-hmm. every day, and no one can expect to be like that,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, that's not how life works. Everything is temporary, even the good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the good days are temporary as much as the bad days are temporary.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not doing too bad. I'm still engaging in therapy. 4 years later,
mm-hmm.
little did I know, 2 weeks, you know, it was going to turn into 4 years. But I recognize the value of that therapy, and I recognize the value of those check-ins and those, you know, that bit of space to talk every, you know, I do it very regularly. Just that opportunity to talk allows me to hear what I'm thinking, hear the voices in my head that I suppose up until age 36 I had in my head, but I didn't listen to. I just told to shut up, I just told to quiet, and, you know, I don't have space for you right now, whereas I have space for them because they are important, those voices, as well as the, you know, the good voices too.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognize that, and I recognize, you know, I suppose what I need in order to feel like I'm having an enjoyable and good life. So I, you know, I've learned where my values lie. My values lie in terms of helping others, teaching others, and sharing time with others to make them feel empowered and confident. And I do that through what I now do on the water. I'm a water sports coach, and I take people out on the water who maybe thought they had never been able to engage in the water before, and show them that they can. And show, you know, like we were talking about at the beginning there, Paul, you know, the idea that you come down, you come on the water with me, and we find your ability. And that I feed off that feedback when I see people smiling because they can do something, or, you know, I just see the body language change because they start to relax, and I get a kick out of that type of feedback. So for me, that's where my values lie in terms of, you know, getting value in my life. And then at the same time, I also recognize what gives me joy. And I recognize I can't have my joy all the time. You know, we can't be eating an ice cream all the time. No. We can't, you know, but at the same time, we are allowed to have joy without earning it. And that's something it took me a long time to recognize. Up until age 36, I thought if I wanted to do anything good or have fun, I had to earn it. I had to be, you know, I had to be a particular type of person. I had to say, well, do you know what? I've done a hard day's work, so now I get to go for a meal out, or go for, you know, a session on the water or whatever. I don't have to, I don't have to have done a hard day's work. You know, I can just go on the water if I want to, and anybody is allowed to do that. You know, anybody is allowed to do what they want to do. We do not have to, you know, subscribe to this idea that, you know, you have to earn a living. And that phrase, I think, is such an irrational phrase, you know, earn a living. You don't have to earn your living. Yes, you have to earn money to, you know, to pay your bills. I get that. But to just be alive, to wake up and breathe the air around you, no, 100%. You don't have to earn that.
Absolutely,
you know?
Right.
And then finally, you know, I suppose it's also what I recognize is that when I'm having a bad day, I'm allowed to have a bad day. I'm allowed to pull the covers up over my head and just say, do you know what, today, nah, it's not going to happen. Because it's not fair on me, and it's also not fair on the others around me, because if the others around me have expectations of what they want me to do that particular day, and I'm having a bad day, I'm sorry, but they're going to be disappointed and I'm going to be disappointed, and it leaves us all in a bad place. So just recognize as well that, you know, there is days that aren't as good as the others. Maybe you won't be able to lie in bed all day, but recognize that maybe the things you want to do that day are the things that people will expect of you. You can, you know, you can reduce the expectation a little bit.
And how often are you on the water? Is your job seasonal, or is it?
It is seasonal, but that doesn't mean I don't get on the water in the off season. My two primary sports nowadays are kite surfing and stand up paddleboarding. And with kite surfing, you need a lot of wind, and with stand up paddleboarding, you need no wind. So I have a nice compliment going on there. You know, days where it's windy, I go out kite surfing, and the days where it's not windy, I go out stand up paddleboarding. But I keep the kite surfing to myself as my own personal thing. I don't teach that. I don't engage in any sort of commercial activity with that. But with the stand up paddleboarding, I take people out, and I coach them and teach them, and I bring them on, you know, experiences and stuff like that. And that one for me is great as well. So it's a nice little brother and sister relationship, you know.
Now, see, I've got a vision of kite surfing. I could be wrong. Is that done on the beach or is that done on the water?
No, it's done on the water. You are attached. Yeah, you're attached to a big kite that's flying in the air, and you have a board under your feet, and you're surfing along the waves.
Right,
it's magic.
That's something to do in Fort Aventura. Would that be right? Isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
There we go.
I've done it there myself.
Wow. Well, Owen, that has been certainly has been an insight. We've covered a lot in a very short space of time, and you never know, we might go back onto this in a year or two's time if you're up for it. But so far, Owen, thanks very much for agreeing to do our podcast. Fair play to you.
No problem at all. And my pleasure, Paul. And thank you for giving this topic the time and space that, you know, it deserves. I suppose what I struggled with when I first became ill was I couldn't find a middle-aged man who had an eating disorder. So hence why I talk, hence why I do what I do now, because I think people out there, this is much more prevalent people realize. And so hopefully someone has listened today and maybe has picked up one or two little nuggets. The last thing, just Paul, before we go, I'd like to say is, you know, just a signpost for people to Bodywise or Beat in the UK. So Bodywise in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, yeah. Or Beat in the UK. They will be the two eating disorders charities or resources that you can contact, and they give you a lot of help.
Perfect, Owen. Thank you.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.